This was a watershed moment in American covert action. It was the first time that there was a real and presidentially authorized plan to assassinate the leader of a foreign country.
Welcome to Global Dispatches, a podcast for the foreign policy and global development communities and anyone who wants a deeper understanding of what is driving events in the world today. I'm your host, Mark Leon Goldberg. I am a veteran international affairs journalist and the editor of UN Dispatch. Enjoy the show. Looking for a trustworthy podcast to bring you unfiltered viewpoints and experiences on global health? Tune into Global Health Matters, the podcast that connects silos and amplifies diverse voices to give you a holistic picture. Each month, Dr. Gary Aslanian from the World Health Organization hosts discussions with guests spanning former ministers of health, award-winning journalists and authors, and frontline public health workers. Join listeners from across 180 countries for an exciting season 4, launching in June. Global Health Matters is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. My guest today, Stuart Reed, is the executive editor of Foreign Affairs and the author of the new book, The Lumumba Plot, The Secret History of the CIA and a Cold War Assassination. The book tells the story of Congo's liberation from Belgium in the 1950s and 60s and the rise to prominence of Patrice Lumumba, Congo's charismatic independence leader. Believing Lumumba to be under the sway of the Soviet Union, the CIA hatched a plot to assassinate him at a time when Congo was falling into a chaotic civil war. And it was into this civil war that UN Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld dispatched a unique peacekeeping mission to restore order. And it was around this time that Dag Hammarskjöld died in a plane crash in the Congo. Stuart Reed weaves each of these narratives into a single compelling story that reads at times like a spy thriller. I could not put this book down. Stayed up way too late reading it each night. I learned so much about colonialism, Cold War history, and the early history of the United Nations. I could not recommend this book more highly. So let's jump right into it. Here is my conversation with Stuart Reed, executive editor of Foreign Affairs and author of The Lumumba Plot. I wanted to kick off by having you kind of explain and describe, you know, the historic and political context in which Patrice Lumumba was born in the Congo in the 1920s. Set the scene for listeners.
So Patrice Lumumba was Congo's first post-independence leader, democratically elected leader, the prime minister of the country. And he was born in 1925 into what was then the Belgian Congo. The Belgians had colonized the Congo River Basin back in the 1880s. Originally, it was the personal fiefdom of King Leopold II, and then it transferred to the Belgian state in 1908. And it was run very differently from many other European colonies in Africa, in that the Belgians really decided to prevent the emergence of any sort of native elite. So this meant that higher education was strictly limited. There were no sort of proto-political institutions, proto-democratic institutions to speak of. So whereas the French and the British allowed a little bit more of educational opportunities and practice for democracy type institutions, there was none of this in the Belgian Congo. And so that made Patrice Lumumba's life story all the more impressive, in that he, in this very cramped context, educated himself. He was born in a rural village, moved to the big city of Stanleyville, now Kisangani, and rose through the ranks of the colonial administration, working for the post office as a postal clerk there, getting as high as he really could as a Congolese man could at the time. And he was arrested for embezzlement in 1956. As he admitted, he took money from the post office that he was working for.
Yeah, I mean, he needed money to live was the kind of explanation that he gave, as you detail in your book, that he was paid like a fraction of what a white person would have been paid at his job. And he was a striver.
Yeah, and that's important context there. So he was paid a fifth of what a white colleague would earn for the exact same job. And he was trying to live as a, quote, Europeanized African man. And what that meant was he wanted his kids to go to learn French in school, to get proper meals. He wanted to have a house befitting of his status. They had this official term called évolué, which meant literally evolved person.
Very racist.
Yeah, but it should be said that Lumumba applied for eagerly, and he was proud to call himself an évolué. But yes, of course, the whole system was based on the idea that there could be certain Europeanized, enlightened Congolese. He applied for and received this status and then really became active in all these circles in Stanleyville, these évolué circles of other Congolese elites. I wouldn't call them political elites yet because politics was banned, but sort of these cultural associations and, you know, the Association of Native Postmen was one organization he was involved in. And so it was in that context that he really became a known quantity around town. And this was now the mid to late 1950s. And as you know, colonialism was coming to an end across Africa at that point.
So how did he go from a self-taught, well-educated postal employee who, you know, was convicted of embezzlement to a nationally known leader in seemingly such a short period of time?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that struck me while researching this is just how quickly everything happened. So in 1957, Lumumba is freed from prison after a little over a year, and he reinvents himself by moving to the capital of the Belgian Congo, Leopoldville, and becoming, of all things, a beer salesman, promoting his brewery's beer over that of the rival one across Leopoldville. And it was in that environment that he learned the local language. He met everyone and sort of became a prominent figure very shortly after moving to the city. And then at the same time, there were starting to be glimmers of nationalism breaking out in the Belgian Congo, much later than they broke out in other countries.
Yeah, I mean, that's worth emphasizing, I think, probably for the reasons you described earlier, which is the suppression of creating like an elite Congolese, that nationalism took much longer time to take hold in the Congo than it did in other African colonies.
And one telling detail is that in 1955, a Belgian academic published a plan for the future of the Belgian Congo called the 30-year plan for the independence of the Belgian Congo. The idea being that only by 1985 would the colony finally be ready for independence. He almost lost his job because that was seen as way too short a timeline by the Belgians. And that was 1955. Things changed really quickly. Nationalism was breaking out elsewhere. And the Belgian strategy of, quote, no elites, no problems, which had worked very well for the Belgians for a while, finally broke down. And people like Lumumba started demanding independence.
So how did Lumumba become like politicized and become an active political leader, go from like a gregarious beer salesman, becoming kind of known in local circles, to becoming a real political force?
I think a lot of that can be traced to his time in jail, which would be the case for many other independence leaders across Africa. That year he spent in prison, I wouldn't say it radicalized him, because if you look at his writings from that time, he wrote a book manuscript while in prison, it's not particularly radical. He's asking for tepid changes to the colonial system. He's not demanding immediate independence. But I think it was a searing experience to spend that time under colonial prison. And then another thing that happened is he started traveling internationally. So in 1958, he goes to Accra in what is now independent Ghana at that time, meets Kwame Nkrumah, and really comes back from that conference a transformed man and starts talking in the Pan-Africanist language of that conference, and the idea that he and other African people across the continent are engaged in the same collective struggle against colonialism. And then also what happens is a sort of competition breaks out, whereby it was always going to be that the whatever Congolese political class came to the fore would be people who were non-political elites originally, of which we can include Lumumba. And once politics started seeping in, there became incentives to sort of outdo one another in terms of demanding immediate independence, complete independence, and so on. And so things really picked up. And then another turning point was in 1959, January 1959, there were anti-colonial riots in Leopoldville, the capital. And that is what really convinced the Belgians that they had to offload their colony as soon as possible. They didn't want an anti-colonial war of the type that was going on in Algeria. And so things moved very quickly after that.
At what point here did the United States become suspicious of Lumumba and begin to discuss internally that he might be like a communist sympathizer, and in the context of the Cold War, he was more on like the Soviet side of things?
Before independence, this had always been an allegation about Lumumba that he was leftist and maybe Soviet friendly, but there wasn't much basis to it. The Belgians detested Lumumba. They had their preferred Congolese political leaders who were much more pliant and wanted to preserve relations with Belgium and not have much of a real independence. Lumumba was not that. He was imprisoned in the fall of 1959, yet again, this time for allegedly inciting a riot after he gave a political speech. He was in the Belgians' bad books, and they passed on all sorts of negative information to their American allies. And so I think the beginning of the negative attitude toward Lumumba begins before independence with the Belgians whispering in the Americans' ear. That said, after independence, there was a sort of wait and see approach. The CIA even at one point contemplated funding Lumumba because they realized that he was probably going to become prime minister, as he did, and they didn't want to be left on the outside looking in. So after independence, the attitude is, okay, he may not be our first choice, but he's someone we can work with. Then, to run through a lot of complicated events very quickly, there's a massive crisis in Congo. The army mutinies, the Belgian military intervenes without Congolese permission, the UN sets up this massive peacekeeping operation, Lumumba tires of that mission, and it's then that he starts making, you know, playing footsie with the Soviets, and that sets off alarm bells in DC. And that's August 1960.
I mean, that set of circumstances, those were, I think, worth describing, if just because, as you noted, you know, he was, as you describe often in your book, like, you know, if had to choose between the United States and the Soviets, he probably would have chosen the United States. He seemed to be more inclined towards the US and less inclined towards the Soviets. And he was, above all, like a nationalist. He really didn't have like ideological commitments to anything other than Congolese nationalism. But because, as you describe so well in his book, his behavior was kind of erratic at times, that seemed to kind of alarm the CIA and the Eisenhower administration in profound ways that sent into motion a plot to kill him.
Right. I mean, the best piece of evidence for Lumumba's inherently pro-American views is the fact that when he visits Washington, D.C. in July 1960, as the crisis is engulfing his country, he asks the United States to send U.S. troops to the Congo, which is hardly the type of thing someone who is pro-Soviet would do. But when he asked the U.S. for troops, they obviously weren't going to do that. No one had any interest in sending Americans to some far-off place. But he asked them for other sorts of aid and was rebuffed. And so he first tried the UN, was frustrated with that. Then he went knocking on the Americans' door, got brushed away. And then, and only then, did he really turn to the Soviets for help.
So what was the plot to assassinate Lumumba?
So it's out of science fiction almost, or a Cold War farce. It begins really on August 18th, 1960, when President Eisenhower is having a meeting with the National Security Council, and Lumumba's latest antics come up, and Eisenhower says something, we don't know his exact words, but we have a lot of reason to know that he said something like this, something to the effect that Lumumba had to be physically eliminated. And so eventually the CIA, under its director at the time, Alan Dulles, sets in motion this bizarre operation. And poisons are flown to the Congo by a CIA chemist named Sidney Gottlieb. And he meets in Leopoldville, the capital, with the station chief there, the CIA station chief. That's a guy named Larry Devlin. And Devlin receives these poisons and is told that they are to be put in Lumumba's food or toothpaste. And that, you know, within 24 hours, Lumumba will be dead and it'll look like he died of some sort of natural cause. This was a watershed moment in American covert action. It was the first time that there was a real and presidentially authorized plan to assassinate the leader of a foreign country. It never ended up coming to fruition for a number of reasons. Namely, by the time the poisons actually arrived in Congo, Lumumba was no longer in power. He had been overthrown in a CIA-supported coup and was under house arrest, and there was no way of actually getting the poisons to him.
But eventually, though, if perhaps by a sin of omission, the United States did seem to greenlight his eventual murder, as you describe in the book.
Right. So Lumumba is killed in January 1961. And to summarize a lot of detail, it's basically with the green light of the CIA station chief there, Larry Devlin. So to make a long story short, Lumumba is under house arrest. Then he escapes house arrest, gets captured, and then put in a military prison. The man in charge of Congo at this point is Joseph Mobutu, the CIA-backed military officer who had taken power. And Mobutu decides at some point in January 1961 to send Lumumba to his death. The timing here is important. The Eisenhower administration is in its final weeks. Kennedy is about to be inaugurated on January 20th, 1961. And there's a real feeling on the ground in Congo that the Kennedy administration might have a more pro-Lumumba policy. Lumumba's been ousted from power. He's languishing in prison. And there's this move to free him from prison and bring him back to power. And there are good reasons to believe that the Kennedy administration might entertain this. So Mobutu is freaking out because he's worried that his rival would be restored to power. And Larry Devlin, the CIA station chief, is freaking out because the man he's staked his whole career opposing and has been instructed to assassinate could be on the verge of returning to power. So on January 14th, 1961, Devlin learns from Mobutu or someone in his circle that Lumumba is about to be sent away to his death. And he makes two choices at that point, which would be really fateful for the history of the Congo and Africa and the world, arguably. One is that he doesn't tell Mobutu to not send Lumumba to his death. And in the context of their very close relationship, where he's passing him briefcases of cash all the time, is responsible for him being in power, this was clearly a green light. The second thing Devlin does is that he deliberately keeps Washington out of the loop because he believes, correctly, if he informs DC of what's about to happen, he'll be told to put the brakes on the operation to save Lumumba. And at that point, it was in the middle of this presidential transition, there had been an edict that went out that said, you know, no big new decisions on policy. And Devlin had just asked for a bunch of money to pay off Mobutu's troops days earlier. And he had been denied that on the grounds that we need to wait for the Kennedy people to take over and then we can decide these things. And so Devlin doesn't update Washington about what's happening, even as he's telling them about other things that are happening. And then on January 17th, 1961, Lumumba is put on a series of planes and sent to the breakaway province of Katanga and tortured the whole flight. And then, you know, shot by a firing squad shortly after getting off the plane. And 3 days later, Kennedy is inaugurated. The timing is not a coincidence.
So your book, I just absolutely love. It's so rich in detail of Cold War history, of the United Nations history, which we can discuss in a bit as well. Because as you mentioned, you know, while there was this mutiny while Lumumba was in power, the Belgians kind of reinvaded. So Lumumba asked the UN to replace the Belgians. And then Lumumba and the UN and the peacekeeping operation there had a rather tense relationship for a long time. And, you know, it was in kind of that context later on that Dag Hammarskjöld died in a plane wreck in pursuit of trying to, you know, settle the issue of, you just mentioned, the breakaway province of Katanga. Can you just talk briefly about the historical significance of the United Nations operations and interventions in the Congo at the time?
You know, it's interesting researching this book because I was much more familiar with the UN of today. And the UN of 1960 is an entirely different beast, almost unrecognizable. I mean, it was much more powerful. It was, you know, on the front page of the newspaper many days in a way that it just isn't today. And Security Council debates were broadcast on television and that sort of thing. And so the Congo operation, in a way, marked the height of the UN's ambitions and power. Never before had the United Nations done anything like what it was doing in the Congo. There had been peacekeeping missions in the Middle East where it was monitoring a truce and that sort of thing, but never before had the UN been responsible for restoring order to an entire country. And at a logistical level, it was an incredibly impressive operation with thousands of troops drawn mostly from African countries arriving in the Congo, you know, within days of the UN Security Council passing this resolution and fanning out across the country. But there was a fundamental problem with it, which was that one of the big obstacles to a united Congo was the fact of this breakaway province, Katanga. It had announced its secession, you know, in the midst of the crisis. It was backed by Belgium. And that province didn't want UN troops intervening and taking over. And Lumumba wanted the UN to act at his behest and thought they were sort of his personal force that could reinvade that province and bring it back into the national fold. Dag Hammarskjöld would have none of that. And so the two were really at loggerheads throughout the crisis, and both were claimed by the crisis, their lives. The UN operation in Congo, I think, was really viewed as a failure afterwards, and that the UN had bitten off more than it could chew. It had naively imagined that it could sort of avoid the Cold War superpower struggle. The Soviets regretted having voted for it. And so that was the last ambitious peacekeeping operation of the Cold War. And you don't really see that many peacekeeping operations until the tail end of the Cold War, you know, late 70s or so, maybe even later than that. I'm not exactly sure. But it was a lesson in the limits of the UN's power. And then also, I think Dag Hammarskjöld, at a personal level, he had really, by dint of his ambition and personality and diplomacy, had turned the Secretary General position into a role with independent diplomatic heft in a way that it hadn't been before him and would never really be after him.
To that point, your story is full of anecdotes, and I just like look up from the book and thinking to myself, my God, that can never happen today. You can't have like the Secretary General ordering peacekeeping troops to like protect someone or to like block the landing of an airplane. That just like doesn't exist as it might today. But, you know, to your point about like the legacy of the United Nations in the DRC, you know, we're speaking within 10 or so months before the current peacekeeping mission, MINUSCO, is scheduled to shut down, you know, after kind of an inglorious ending to a peacekeeping mission. I mean, when you look and survey the UN's involvement in the Congo today, do you see hints or relics of the same challenges that it faced in the 1960s in that initial mission?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the parallels are almost eerie between now and 1960. You have a dysfunctional central government in Congo in both time periods. You have widespread instability in both periods. And you have a United Nations mission that is deeply unpopular among the political leaders who invited it in. I think the fundamental problem here is not the UN peacekeeping operation. It's the Congolese government and its inability to exert control over all of its territory and its repressive and rapacious rule over the areas that it does control. And here I'm especially talking about the east of the country, which is where the UN peacekeeping operation is concentrated. I mean, Congo has had just a really disappointing post-independence period, you know, beginning in 1960. And as I've argued, I think you can pin a great deal of the blame on the United States. The key decisions that were taken by the U.S. in 1960 and 1961 were, one, to eliminate Lumumba, which thus deprived Congo of a popular politician who represented a legitimate strain of public opinion. And second, the decision to replace him with Mobutu, a military officer turned dictator who was not representative, was extremely repressive, but he was ostensibly pro-American in the Cold War context. So that led, as you know, to a 30-plus year rule by Mobutu, propped up by the United States until the end of the Cold War, at which point, predictably, his regime outright collapsed. And then that collapse kicked off a devastating civil war that killed literally millions of people, and we're still dealing with the effects of it to this day. So the instability in the DRC today, I think you can really draw quite a straight line back to the decisions taken in 1960 and 61.
So those linkages, I think, are something that many people in the Congo today recognize and represent. It's not something, I think, that those in the United States, even those who work on like Africa policy, really, I think, sufficiently appreciate, particularly when working and designing policies towards the DRC today. And, you know, a lot of policy towards the DRC today, at least from the United States, is kind of viewed in the context of competition with China. I mean, you mentioned Katanga earlier. This is one of the key mineral sources in all the world for some of the key ingredients in consumer electronics and, more importantly, in electrical vehicles. And you see this emerging competition now between the United States and China over resources in Katanga and in the DRC more broadly. And I just wonder how much of this like history is influencing decision-making at the moment.
You know, I think U.S. policymakers currently are probably relatively historically amnesic. Is that the right actual type of form? So I think the historical parallels are real and striking to people like you and me, but I doubt they motivate much of U.S. policymaking. I mean, one thing that struck me is I expected that the Congolese people would be relatively anti-American, given all that the CIA had done to screw up their country back in the 1960s. But that's actually not the case. They're quite pro-American, like many countries in sub-Saharan Africa are. And I sort of had this puzzle of why is that? One theory I have is that the country was ruled by a pro-American dictator for 30 plus years. So he wasn't going to talk about America, the great Satan, the way that, you know, revolutionary Iran did. So you didn't have that sort of decades of Cold War anti-American propaganda. But I think there is a different way in which this affects the Congolese politics, which is that there's a real culture of conspiracy theory thinking in Congo and a view that foreign powers are always out to destroy Congo and meddle in its politics. And often that doesn't have a whole lot of basis in the present reality, but it certainly was true in 1960. And it arguably is true of, you know, what some foreign companies are doing to Congo today. So, I mean, I've made the argument that the United States certainly owes Congo an apology. One could debate what the practical effects of such an apology would be, and I'm politically realistic enough to realize that this is not very high on President Biden's agenda. But I think as a start, at a minimum, the U.S. government should declassify everything related to the CIA's operations in Congo in 1960, in the 1960s. I mean, so much of it during my research was, to my endless frustration, still classified. And, you know, more than 60 years later, there's just really nothing that should be secret, in my opinion. So that would be a first step, I think.
Yeah, if my experience of dealing with FOIA stuff is anything like yours, like, you know, 10 years from now, you'll get an email back or a box of documents with a lot of stuff redacted from it.
You know, I deliberately didn't even try the FOIA route because I had been warned by so many other journalists that, you know, it's fruitless and will take a decade. To the government's credit, in 2013, there was a big trove of CIA cables that was declassified and released in a State Department volume. So I wouldn't have been able to write the book without that trove, in fact. So there has been some progress, but it's slow and incomplete.
Congratulations. I really love the book.
Thanks so much, Mark.
Thanks for listening to Global Dispatches. The show is produced by me, Mark Leon Goldberg. It is edited and mixed by Levi Sharp. If you are listening on Apple Podcasts, make sure to follow the show and enable automatic downloads to get new episodes as soon as they're released. On Spotify, tap the bell icon to get a notification when we publish new episodes. And of course, please visit globaldispatches.org to get on our free mailing list, get in touch with me, and access our full archive. Thank you.